The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers.
And from Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
You're listening to Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Jimmy Gutierrez, here with Daniela Alley.
Today on the show, the first in a four-part series on the state of the jails and prisons in New Hampshire.
In the U.S., roughly one-third of the adult population have a criminal record. That's just about the same number of people with a college degree. But much more often, college graduates, compared to ex-convicts, feel so much more visible in our society. And the institutions and criminal justice system are almost impenetrable if you're outside of them.
New Hampshire might have one of the lowest crime rates in the country, but our prison population has been one of the fastest growing.
So we wanted to know, how do national questions about mass incarceration, inmate labor in prisons, addiction treatment, mental health, shake out in the state prisons, county jails, and courtrooms in New Hampshire?
What does New Hampshire's system look like, and what is it like to live through it?
Going to jail for the first time, if you stay just long enough, you get scared and never want to go back. But if you stay over that point, then you get out and go, that's no big deal.
This is Bill Blanchard from Claremont. And like a lot of people who get caught up in the criminal justice system, Bill first came in contact with law enforcement when he was just a kid. And it started with money.
There was a freedom with having money. That literally was the issue. I could get what I wanted. I didn't have to have welfare cheese anymore.
In the 80s, Bill was growing up in Orlando, Florida, in a housing development called Sand Lake Apartments. He said his family was incredibly poor, and so Bill began to steal.
He stole food stamps from his mom's wallet, and he'd get a Dr. Pepper or Reese's cup before school. In the eighth grade, he quit school altogether and started selling marijuana. That escalated to harder drugs.
Bill ended up moving to New Hampshire in his early 20s, looking to get away from trouble. But at that time, getting in trouble was all Bill knew. He racked up charges both here and in Vermont.
Because we never thought about, is this a Class A felony, misdemeanor, class? You never think of those. You know, I love when everyone thinks that law makes a deterrent. No one ever thinks about going, you know what, if I shoot him, I'll get this one. But if I just hurt him, it doesn't work that way. It's reaction. It's emotion.
Like a lot of us, Bill was clueless about the criminal justice system. When he was arrested in New Hampshire, charged but not yet convicted, he didn't even know that he had a right to representation.
There's no lawyer at the door. When you're arrested, there's, you know, on the movies, the rich people have the lawyer meet them while they're still being investigated or interrogated. Not if you're ghetto, man. If you got a public defender, you don't see that dude for weeks.
The U.S. Supreme Court has made really clear that individuals need to have counsel when they're going before a criminal court, when they're going through our criminal justice system.
This is Devin Chafee, Executive Director of New Hampshire's ACLU.
However, unfortunately, in practical terms, you know, in many areas of the country, that often that counsel is not adequate. And in other areas, individuals aren't getting counsel at really key hearings or stages of their interaction with the criminal justice system.
This leads to what is commonly referred to as a two-tier system of justice, where for some, often white people of means, that can afford a good lawyer, the justice system can be forgiving, even relaxed. And for others, those with less money and resources, who often aren't white, it can be extremely punitive.
And it can have an incredible impact on the outcome for these individuals' cases, and that can have an incredible impact on their lives.
In New Hampshire, the state actually provides legal representation in criminal cases for people deemed too poor to afford an attorney through the Public Defender's Office. This was the case for Bill.
Those people are actually charged fees after their criminal case is resolved, whether they're acquitted or whether they're convicted.
But with all the trouble Bill had gotten into, the charge that finally sunk him, that would send him to a state prison, wasn't a violent crime. It wasn't selling drugs. It was a burglary when he stole a flashlight.
And then the lawyer tells you, well, you see this burglary you did, it was after dusk. So technically, I went to prison for a flashlight.
So this is where the process of incarceration starts, after you get convicted like Bill did. Now, sometimes if you're in Bill's position, there are programs that help people avoid jail or prison time for certain crimes.
Some counties in the state have what's called diversion or pretrial services. This is where defendants who have been charged with a crime are referred for a chance to avoid being locked up. It also offers life skills and substance misuse treatment. And it's a program that comes with intense supervision.
Right. And as these programs can reduce jail and prison populations, they're not without critique. There's a ton of supervision, which can include unannounced visits, drug tests, and electronic monitoring. But people from both corrections and the public believe it's a better option than locking people up and taking them out of their communities.
And away from their families, and take away their ability to earn.
And again, the who of our jail and prison population comes back to money.
We know that in the recent history, the percentage of individuals incarcerated in New Hampshire that our pretrial has been around 50%, and so that's, you know, half of the individuals incarcerated hadn't even been convicted of a crime.
The reason why half of our jail population is behind bars is a four-letter word, bail.
The idea of bail originally was that you would require that somebody paid bail so that after they were charged with a crime so that they would come back to court.
But you're not a guilty person. You're innocent until proven guilty. But in our system of justice, if you can't make that bail to guarantee your appearance for court, you're here in jail. So some of your liberty has been taken away.
This is Rick Van Wickler, and we spoke to him last fall. He's the superintendent of Cheshire County Department of Corrections, and he also oversees the county jail.
I have, in this jail, I can hold 230 inmates. I have about 164 inmates here today. 18 of them are sentenced. That's mind-blowing, because for the 3 decades that I've been doing this, 60% was pretrial, 40% were sentenced consistently. So now I'm predominantly pretrial. Most of those are people who cannot make bail.
Now, bail, to clarify, is basically a payment you make to the court if you want to get out of jail after you're arrested. Last year, New Hampshire pushed bail reforms, but the rollout among the 10 counties in the state has been inconsistent. Many people see cash bail as the newest iteration of mass incarceration, or one of the reasons we've seen this explosion of the jail and prison populations in the last few decades.
In New Hampshire, we often like to think of ourselves as the exception, and we are exceptional in many ways, but we have followed the national trend when it comes to the soaring rates of incarceration in our states. Rates of incarceration in New Hampshire have grown nearly ninefold between 1980 and 2016. And over this time, you've actually seen a decrease in the rates of crime.
One of the main reasons why there's been such a staggering increase in not just incarceration rates, but also length of sentences, is from our war on drugs.
Well, we say we're a society that supports second chances, but in reality, we're not.
This is Michelle Alexander, lawyer, scholar, and author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Color Blindness.
To fully understand what's happened in this country with respect to mass incarceration, you have to look back at least 40 years to the law and order movement that was born in the midst of the civil rights movement.
This is the first time in the history of our struggle that we have been able, literally, to fill the jail.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse.
When the war on drugs began in 1971, our prison population was 200,000. Today it is over 2 million.
Sentences have gotten much, much longer, over the past 3 to 4 decades since the 1970s. And so what determines what that sentence is right now can be any number of factors.
First of all, there's the prosecutor. These are people who have a huge amount of power when considering what charge to bring and how much time someone could spend incarcerated.
Prosecutors are probably the most influential and powerful actors in the criminal justice system. The way that prosecutors come into their role varies. Most district attorneys, as they're called in other states, they're county attorneys in New Hampshire. That's the name for them in New Hampshire, are actually elected by the public.
So when Bill went to court for his felony, stealing the flashlight, and everything had been weighed by the county attorney, it came time for the judge's sentence. How long would he be locked up?
So when you get sentenced, there's a finality to all of that turmoil and in frustration and you're vexed back and forth.
Bill agreed to a plea deal of 1.5 to 3 years and then another 1.5 to 3 years consecutive.
But when the judge slams that gavel, there's a sigh of relief. And then there's the, okay, nothing you can do is going to change this. Either you flip that mental switch or you will suffer. Your flesh is saying, I don't want to go. I was hoping to get a chance, a second chance. You know, I wanted another opportunity. But you sit in the holding cell waiting for them to transport you, knowing this is it.
When word of mouth returns from a break, we'll look into what happens after you're sentenced and waiting for transport. What's life inside prison like?
When you pull up to Concord, it's like out of a movie. Seriously, if you looked at the front of Concord, it looks like you're in a 1940s or 50s jail.
This is Bill Blanchard again. It's 1993, and he's heading to the state prison for stealing a flashlight.
You have no idea the vast amount of acreage behind it. You have no idea how huge that prison is, because all you see is this long brick building, almost like a mill building with razor wire.
He gets to the booking area, the paint's chipped, it's incredibly loud, and this is where he's checked into the prison.
And there's a lot of process of bend over, spread your cheeks, and cough. And there's no room for argument. So you go through and you get processed, get your, they call them greens, you get your net bag, you get your allotted number of towels. You're taking in so much information, like how many guards there are, what's going on, who's screaming, who's yelling. You're just taking in data and you're trying to process it for your own survival.
Bill was met by corrections professionals like this guy.
This isn't the kind of thing where you apply, get a job, and punch in and punch out and do it based on instinct. Although a lot of people have retired doing that, it's not the right way to do it.
This is Rick Van Wickler again, and that booking process Bill went through, that's usually the norm at both prisons and jails. New Hampshire has 10 county jails, 3 state prisons, 2 for men, 1 women's, 1 federal prison, 2 juvenile centers, and 1 jail that also serves as an immigration detention center. And one big difference between jail and prison is how long inmates stay. In jails, people are there for misdemeanor, so typically they're there for less than a year.
People who have committed felonies usually go to prison, and those sentences are usually for more than a year. And there's another central difference. Who runs the institution? The state or federal government runs prisons. Jails, those are under county control.
I would dare say that there's no 2 county jails that operate exactly alike. I would say that there's no 2 county jails in New Hampshire that have the exact same philosophy. We have differing opinions on a lot of different things.
So let's say Bill had gone to Cheshire County Jail. His booking process would have been completely different.
In traditional corrections, everybody, 100% that came in, was strip searched and put into a segregation cell until they were processed and assigned a cell. Modern inmate behavior management creates an environment of incentives and disincentives. So if the individual comes in and they're cooperative, they're not yelling, screaming, not aggressive, they just get pat searched and they're told to have a seat over here, like at the clinic.
3 weeks into his sentence, Bill had assaulted an officer and he was sent to solitary confinement. It's called the Secure Housing Unit, better known as SHU.
And you look in, and I remember thinking, it looks like a spaceship. There's this control room that is 6 feet or so. It looks like it's above the ground and it's a spaceship looking. And there's rows of tiers, left, right, center. But all the guards walk up to you with such intensity, full body armor, helmets. You can't see their face. They're like on the ground. And you're on your knees facing a wall very quickly.
He was there for 10 days and eventually he made it to general population. This is where the regular prisoners are, those who aren't in solitary, maximum security, or, say, the medical unit.
Now, county jails also have solitary. Rick calls his segregation. His internal policy is that the maximum amount of time that people can spend there in isolation is 15 days, and it's a last resort, he says, except when people arrive. Because of the opioid crisis and drugs being smuggled in, Rick will isolate someone for a few days when they're admitted so he can be sure that they can pass a drug test before they go into general population.
Rick says each county has their own policies when it comes to this, and that autonomy is a double-edged sword. He likes having his own control, but he says New Hampshire's criminal justice system is a criminal justice non-system. Counties, police departments, and courts use different inmate management software, and not all county jails have the same kinds of programs around education or substance use or mental health.
Before his time at the Men's State Prison in Concord, Bill spent time at the Grafton County Jail. He says the programming there changed everything.
I used to have this saying, it's like, I'm never wrong, and if I am, it's because of something you made me do. So when you stop that and you turn that mirror around and realize you're the only one there, that you are completely 100% accountable for every decision you make, even if that decision is a reaction to an action.
That change started with a class an older couple taught called Thresholds Decision Making.
So she was doing this whole class, and it was all about how do you think, how do you react, what leads to your thoughts. And I was still using that those tools as the fundamentals to get me through even prison. All right, I think this dude might have, you know, dissed me on something. Should I go deal with that or let it go?
Bill realized for a lot of his life, he had just been reacting. He hadn't spent a lot of time delving into critical thinking or brainstorming.
In prison, he started taking other classes, math, American literature, and eventually he decided he would go to college, be the first in his family to do so. In all of these classes, they would not have been available to Bill if he had been a woman.
I will tell you that the men's prison has a heck of a lot more programs. We have no driver's ed. We have no woodworking. We have a very small library.
This is Kim. She spent 4 months in the women's prison when it was still in Goffstown in 2011. Today, the men's prison has 8 career and technical programs, compared to just 2 for the women's prison.
My mom would send in money for canteen and order stuff off books just so I could make bracelets, or you could, you know, crochet if you wanted to. I didn't know how to do that.
But today, there's another type of programming that prisons and jails need to focus on because of who they're seeing come through the doors. More and more people who come into contact with the criminal justice system are dealing with substance use disorders or mental illness. And this is something that Rick sees a lot of in Cheshire County.
32% of the people in our nation's jails are diagnosed with a mental illness. The jail in your community is the largest mental health facility in your community.
Each jail has complete discretion over how they address these issues, and most county jails offer limited treatment for substance use disorder. But there's a bigger question for Rick in all of this.
Well, as a citizen, I'm saying, why would an addict turn themselves into the police or a fire station? Doesn't make sense to me. Why can't they turn themselves into a treatment center that's not available? Or the ones that are available, there's no bed available. Or if there is a bed available, you can't be struggling sober. You have to be wasted in order to get in.
When Kim was sent to prison at 38 years old, it was because of a drug problem that had been building for decades, untreated. A drug problem that started when she was a young teen, after being molested for years by a family member.
I have a 15-year-old son at that time, and he didn't come and see me until I went to the halfway house because he was angry at me. Unfortunately, I buried my sorrows and my pain through addiction.
When Kim was arrested, she signed over custody of her son and 2 young daughters, at the time ages 2 and 3, to her mother. When they came for visitations at the prison, her mom told the girls that Kim was in school.
But my mother would bring my family in, and they treated my mother horrible, almost like she was an inmate, and it was her fault that I was there, and my kids, and they have to go through the metal detector, and I couldn't touch them, and they could play with toys that were disgusting. It was just, it was almost like I didn't want them to come because I was penalizing my mom more, and I had already done enough damage to her.
Bill also had visitors, and one unexpected visitor. It was his Uncle Dick, who had been close with Bill's father, and they had even played music together.
He would come and buy me 3 packs of smokes, and you could get $10 in change, and we would have Cokes and some chips and play cribbage.
Uncle Dick became Bill's support system, his bridge back to life outside of prison.
And he came faithfully every week, man. He would come down, snow, didn't matter. And I end up bonding with this guy who I would have never have like chosen to hang out with. He's responsible. I'm irresponsible. He's hardworking. I'm a slacker.
Bill's time was wrapping up, and he decided to apply for parole. This is a way for eligible prisoners to get out early on the condition of good behavior. In New Hampshire, like most of the country, there's a parole board that decides this. It's a group of seven people appointed by the governor and executive council. They're not required to have been lawyers, but they review each prisoner's application for parole. And each prisoner gets a hearing where they're asked all sorts of questions by the board, who vote on whether or not to grant parole.
We go to my first parole hearing, and they deny me. So my uncle stood up and said, well, what about living with me? And I remember looking back going, whoa, really?
The board approved that arrangement and put Bill on high-intensity parole. He had an 8 p.m. curfew and had to go to three Alcoholics Anonymous meetings a week. But he was cleared to work, or at least to try and find a job.
His Uncle Dick got him an interview to work at a restaurant in West Lebanon.
And Concord made me go to that interview in my greens with a correctional officer standing next to me. My sister brought me a suit, and they go, what's that for? And she goes, well, my brother's going to a job interview. And they go, no, he can't wear that.
Bill was understandably nervous. Other prisoners he knew were denied jobs in part because they were forced to do an interview in prison clothing and because they couldn't start right away.
He looked across the table and says, I'll give you a job. And then I had to give him the news and say, even though you gave me the job, it takes an average of a month for them to process me to have parole where I will actually be on the street to start. I thought for sure he was going to go, well, I can't do that, man. I kind of need you if we're going to do this. I'm looking to hire. He goes, nope, okay. Went back to prison, the most elated person ever.
Bill says a lot of guys he knew wouldn't even apply for parole. They'd rather just serve their max sentence and get their $100 to start a new life. He says he would have been one of those guys. But someone took a chance on him. His uncle, the restaurant owner. So here he was, finally released to try and start a new life in the shadow of his time incarcerated.
Every day was like, is today the day I'm going to do really good in school? Or could I get violated? Is there something foolish going to happen? You walk on eggshells until you're done. And even when you're done, now you have a record.
Challenges of reentry after incarceration are both impossible to miss, like a corrections officer standing over your shoulder in a job interview, and invisible to see, like getting denied housing after a landlord runs a background check.
While Bill was paroled to his uncle's house, Kim served out the rest of her sentence at Shea Farm Transitional Housing. It's a minimum security facility, or a program commonly referred to as work release.
When I went to the halfway house, it was like starting my first day in prison again. I was put into a room with 18 girls, all in bunk beds. And I'm not telling you that it's a nice bed or a nice pillow or that you can have peace, quiet, privacy, anything like that.
It also cost Kim $63 a week to stay there.
The price has probably gone up now because we're talking 2012.
She ended up getting a job at Friendly's through a woman at Shea Farm for $3.27 an hour plus tips. She would walk miles to and from work, sometimes in the dark, sometimes after working a double, sometimes in rain and snow, so she could start supporting her young children, who her mom was taking care of.
For Bill, when he was released almost 24 years ago, he didn't have kids, and his sights were set on college. Soon, he began attending NHTI.
I went from convict to college, no one in my family, no one, cause no one's been. I'm going, this is weird. There's some things that are similar to, you know, prison. I got this concrete room. I got one bunk. I got my own little fridge, though. It's kind of a bonus. I got to be told when to be in the dorm because they locked the dorm. When not, who we can have over me. It was hard sneaking my wife in for the weekends.
Now, Bill was still on parole. That means that even one little slip-up and he's sent right back to prison.
I did fall. I had an inmate that I was locked up with, showed up at the college one day. Come to find out he had stolen his boss's truck. I was riding in it. Foolish, but had I been pulled over with him, being with another inmate, being in a stolen vehicle, I'd have been violated. Everything I worked for, gone, based on a small lapse of judgment.
Now, both Bill and Kim were extremely fortunate in the fact that they had a relatively easy time securing a job and housing, but that's not always the case.
Data from the Prison Policy Initiative suggests that the job market for ex-felons is about the same as the general job market during the Great Depression.
And while New Hampshire has one of the lowest crime rates in the country, it's also had one of the fastest growing prison populations of both men and women. Between 2000 and 2016, that population grew by 16%.
So what's the ultimate purpose of all this, of having people in jail or in prison? Is it to punish?
Or is it to rehabilitate?
Second chance is very important. Sometimes even a third chance is very important. And people do change. They do change. But sometimes it requires resources. And above all, what doesn't cost any money is that it requires insight, education, and understanding on the part of the law enforcement officials.
There is a spectrum of approaches when it comes to corrections. Some folks are more thoughtful, like Rick Van Wickler in Cheshire County, but there are many others on the opposite end who aren't as interested in rehabilitation.
Take, for example, Joe Arpaio, Maricopa County Sheriff for 24 years.
It costs $1.15 a day, to feed the dogs. It's 90 cents a day to feed the prisoners. I'm very proud of that.
Last year, there was a national prison strike across the country to draw attention to both prison conditions and prison labor practices.
Practices that amount to what they call modern slavery. Organizers say it will go on until September 9th and will involve peaceful tactics.
Back in the 60s and 70s, there was a movement to abolish prisons. That's when we first saw a dramatic increase in the prison population under Nixon's war on crime, which was followed up by the Attica prison riots and other prison uprisings.
Those conversations have been pushed forward again by activism surrounding mass incarceration, last year's strikes, and as recently as last week, when prisoners at the MDC jail in Brooklyn went a whole week without heat in the middle of a polar vortex.
We're inadequately trained and we're inadequately prepared for what it is we're really supposed to be doing. The turnover in corrections is quite high. 72% of the people in corrections nationwide have less than 5 years of experience. So we're always struggling to find people who understands the academics of corrections rather than just the desire to control human behavior.
One of the metrics people point to gauge the effectiveness or ineffectiveness of incarceration are recidivism rates.
Or how likely someone with a record will reoffend.
Most recent state numbers put the likelihood that someone will reoffend 5 years after they're released at over 75%. Bill and Kim both say they've been able to stay out of trouble because they've had a ton of support.
And I had the most moral support to this day from my mother, only because she told me that I have to do whatever I have to do.
Kim was released from Shea Farm to her mom's home, who Kim calls her backbone and even has a tattoo of her name down her spine.
And she just believes that I'm going to get better. So without that moral support of your family members and them not giving up, you could drastically have a downward spiral and do more situations and crimes in prison.
Today, Bill is married with 5 kids and works as an ER nurse. But his story is not the norm.
As for Kim, she started working with a diversion program while on parole. That's a service that provides first-time felons an opportunity to expunge their records. She shares her story with offenders once a month for no pay in hopes that her story saves at least one person from the heartbreak she knows.
I do destroy myself when I go in and say that speech. I do bawl my eyes out. But I feel that that's my need to keep my sobriety because I walk on eggshells, and once an addict, always an addict, so I always have to be careful. I can't be around any of my friends anymore. I hang out with just my mom now because all those friends weren't there for me when I was in prison. And when you get out, if you keep in that circle, because I was an addict, then I would have been right back where I started. So it was almost like I had to come into a whole new world.
Over the next few weeks, word of mouth is going deep on incarceration in the state. You all, the listeners, sent us a lot of questions about how prisons and jails work, and what the experience of incarceration is like, and what the problems with the system are. On our next episode, addiction to heroin and other opioids. It's the single biggest health crisis in our state.
Especially in rural communities where people have a harder time accessing treatment. Sometimes sheriffs, police leaders, they support the idea of just trying to lock people up because there's nothing else that they can do for them.
The drug crisis is an incarceration crisis. That's next time on Word of Mouth. Also coming up as a part of our series on incarceration. Within the walls of the state prison, inmates have jobs. In New Hampshire's correctional industries, inmate workers build furniture, engrave signs, operate printing presses, and manufacture all of the license plates for the state of New Hampshire for a wage starting at $2.15 a day.
We produce approximately 500,000 plates a year, license plates a year, for the Department of Safety. So If there's a license plate on your car, then it came from here.
The question is this ethical?
The provision in the 13th Amendment that allows for unpaid labor in prison says that, you know, unpaid bonded labor shall not be allowed in the U.S. except as punishment for a crime. Theoretically, you know, are these programs punishment?
This whole prison series started because listeners like you emailed us, left us voicemails, and asked us questions about the criminal justice system. And here at Word of Mouth, we've got a team of reporters. It's me and Jimmy and a couple of our colleagues. We'll track down answers to questions that, you know, you just can't Google. So email us your questions about New Hampshire. We're at wordofmouth@nhpr.org, or leave us a voicemail on our hotline, 603-513-7796. This episode was produced by me, Daniela Ali, and Jimmy Gutierrez. Our staff includes Justine Paradise and Ben Henry, with editing help from Jack Rodolico and Maureen McMurray. Our executive producer is Erica Janik. We're supported in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.